presented by B Matters, with host Jacqueline Peterson and Dr. Haley Estrom.
Feeding does matter.
Hey everyone, welcome to Feeding Does Matter. I'm Jacqueline Peterson, CEO of Feeding Matters.
And I'm Haley Estrom. I'm an associate professor in the School of Nursing at UNCW.
Hi, Haley.
Hi, Jacqueline. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty well. I think we're both a little fatigued. It's just as times go, these times. But these are always energizing conversations. And so super excited to talk with our guests because you know them very, very well. So why don't you kick us off?
Yeah. Well, the reason for my fatigue is that I was visiting one of my newest family members who happens to be in a neonatal intensive care unit. And the person who is here with us today is Dr. Jinhee Park and Jinhee Park Sung. And she has her research that she does with our youngest patients that are in the neonatal intensive care unit. And I found myself just thinking of her the entire time and the work she does with feeding for infants in the NICU. I've known Jinhee for a long time since I started my PhD journey when we were both students, but she had been a student already. She's always been a bit ahead of me and someone I've always looked up to. So I'm just so glad to have her here with us today. She is now an associate professor in the School of Nursing at Boston College. And she is also a part of the Feeding Flock research team that we're both founding members of. And she also volunteers with Feeding Matters. So, Dr. Jinhee Park,
amazing
we're
things.
So glad to have you here.
So glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for inviting me to this podcast. And I'm really happy to be here. So yeah, thank you for the introduction, but just a little bit about me. I'm originally from South Korea, and I completed my nursing degrees and began my clinical training actually there in South Korea. Then I came to the United States to pursue my PhD, and somehow I ended up staying and building my career here. So, you know, now I'm in Boston, you know, as Haley mentioned, I'm associate professor there.
Wonderful, Jinhee. Well, it's a pleasure to have you. So excited to get to know your work a little bit more and share it with our audience. I know that your work sits at such an important intersection of this world and our community at Feeding Matters. Maybe can you share a little bit about how you got into this particular work? I know you kind of started with South Korea and BMI and kind of coming over here for your PhD. But what maybe got you interested in feeding or in the NICU and that world? Because we always find it really interesting, people's journeys into this field as a specialty.
Yeah.
Right. And there are other parts of the NICU. Yeah. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, exactly. Like, kind of like what got you to NICU and then what got you to feeding?
Yeah.
Sure. I'm happy to answer that. So I guess to answer your questions, I probably need to take you back a little to when I was a young nursing student and, you know, just starting to figure out what kind of nurses I want to be.
Sure.
So as a nursing student, I mean, Haley knows this. I always love pediatrics. I just always love babies, right? So I'm that person. I'm still doing it. You know, who waves at babies in restaurants or grocery stores?
Yes.
Yeah.
I am too.
So, yeah. And then during the third year of my nursing program, we had a clinical rotations in pediatric, including 1 week in the NICU. And I still remember walking into the NICU for the first time because, I don't know, just something just clicked. And then I thought, that is it. And that is where I want to be. So I applied for my final clinical rotations in the NICU for that reason. And during that experience, I realized just, you know, how special NICU nursing is. Of course, there is a lot of highly technical part of the care, especially when it comes to level 3 NICU, where we care for critically ill infants and very premature infants, right? But there's also so much focus on kind of helping baby grow and develop, right? So we feed them and we comfort them. And we also help them kind of learn and adjust to their tiny bodies and new experiences. And most importantly, we support families during one of the most stressful time of their life. So to me, it feels very meaningful and dynamic. So I became a NICU nurse and work there for a little over 3 years, I think. So, but during those years, I kind of started noticing something. So, you know, when baby began oral feeding, it was usually seen as a kind of really big milestones, right? So typically a sign they're really getting close to going home. Sure. But I also saw that, you know, some babies struggle more than others. So, and, you know, when feeding becomes stressful and problematic, and it created a kind of ripple effects, kind of affecting their breedings and their stabilities, and sometimes how they responded to feeding over time.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of began thinking about, like, are we paying enough attention to how baby learned to feed? Because we didn't talk much about stress during feeding. We didn't talk much about how early feeding experience might shape long-term development. And so I had lots of questions, but unfortunately, there wasn't much research to guide us. So that kind of curiosity is really what led me to pursue my advanced degree. So, you know, starting with my master's and PhD and postdoc, you know, I didn't really plan for that kind of long educational journey, but I ended up having really long educational journey. So
just because you were curious and saw the gap.
It's
really interesting.
So for my master's thesis, I studied whether, non-nutrient sucking, you know, basically using pacifier before feeding could help regulate infant states. Because, you know, sometimes babies are too sleepy, sometimes they're too irritable. So I wanted to know if we help them reach a more organized state before feeding, would feeding go better? And it actually did. I mean, of course, it was my master's study, so it wasn't perfect study, small sample size, short follow-up, but I think it was kind of a turning point for me that, because I realized that small and thoughtful interventions could actually make a real difference, right? So, and then also during my master's program, you know, I work as a teaching assistant, so, you know, that kind of, you know, when I realized I love teaching too. So I started asking myself, is there a job or kind of way to combine clinical care, research, and teaching, right? Perfect, right? So I wanted to get a faculty position. And, you know, that question actually led me to pursue my PhD at University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, where I met Haley, and later postdoc training at Duke. So, and during that time, I had an incredible mentors and colleague who helped me see feeding not just as a task, but as a kind of neurodevelopmental and relational process. And that's really how my research journey began. Yeah. So if you want, I can talk a little bit more about like my dissertation work or something.
It was just, you had such a great like clip. I was writing it down.
I love how you described just the NICU and just like your first impressions of the babies and how they grow and develop and how there's the elements of comfort and like how there are technical elements, but there's also the need for them to grow and develop and how there's the need to give comfort and how the families are there too.
Yeah.
And I really see that all along your trajectory and your program of research, Jinhee, and how you're always considering the families, but you also have the technical elements in your program of research, and that you're able to do all these highly technical analyses and use the equipment. And you, like, even today, you use technical things, like you use sensors and you use, you know, technical bottles. you use a lot of quant things and equipment, and you know, you use a cart and you do all the things.
As a
person from the more qualitative bent of the research world, like looking at what you do, you're able to approach it from all these angles, and I really appreciate how you have that breadth and depth of your approach.
Thank you for saying that.
Like you have the software and the hardware.
Yeah, I think it's a really good way. Yeah, it's really nice.
Perfect way to describe it.
Right. Because one of the reasons I'm kind of, you know, using a lot of sensors and devices really kind of because of the unique nature of my population I'm working with, because you know, they cannot really tell me what they need and how they feel, how they you know, right? So I had to figure out the way kind of capture their voices better. So that's the kind of my modality to capture their voices and, you know, empower them. So that's how I ended up using those devices.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that in particular, and just in general, your research work.
Because,
you know, I think it would be helpful to for the audience to better understand it.
Oh, sure. So I can probably talk a little bit about my doctoral studies, because it definitely used my, you know, both objective and subjective measures to understand comprehensive feeding, you know, assessment. So during my doctoral training, so, you know, I think I kind of began like digging deeper into feeding at that point, you know, not just whether baby can feed, but how we support them during feeding, basically. So, you know, as we all know, infants in the NICU, especially those born prematurely, often struggle with oral feeding because many systems involved, like their neurologic system, breathing system, or digestive system, are still developing, right? So maybe from the outside, feeding may look fairly simple, but in reality, it's pretty complex, requiring very complex coordination between sucking, swallowing, and breathing. That's probably why I use highly technical devices to look at those things. But and then also, I think the early feeding also happened, especially for premature infants, also happened during the kind of critical period of brain development, because, you know, the brain is growing rapidly during that period. So what infant experience during that time can shape how their system develops. So, for example, when feeding is repeatedly stressful, you know, when baby experience oxygen drop, breathing interruption, or instability almost for every feeding, then that stress may influence how they regulate and possibly how they experience feeding long term, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept asking myself, what can we change in the environment to make the feeding less stressful and more positive for the babies? And then one thing I think we can adjust is how we hold the baby during feeding. Actually, for a long time, the spine, or, you know, basically lying on back or upright position were kind of common practice in the NICU when we are feeding premature infants during bottle feeding. But during my pre-doctoral trainings, there was a kind of growing interest in side lying position. So, you know, clinician often said, I feel like babies seem more stable this way, you know, but there wasn't strong evidence yet to support that. So, and as I thought more about it, you know, it actually started make sense to me, because, you know, in side lying, gravity works a little bit differently compared to the spine or upright position. So the milk flow may be a little bit slower, easier for babies to manage, in part because if you think about how the bottle is angled, you know, in the spine versus side lying, and baby may also, you know, be able to expand their chest a little bit better because, you know, there is a little bit reduced gravitational kind of effects on the chest wall. So which can support breathing while they are trying to coordinate suckings and swallowings. And also side lying actually, you know, very common position during breastfeeding. So, you know, clinically, we often see baby look more organized and stable at rest compared to the bottle. So I started wondering if positioning might be part of that difference. Mm. And then also many parents hope to breastfeeding, even though there are real challenges in the NICU. So I also thought if bottle feeding happens in a similar position, then it might create more consistent experience and make their transition a little smoother later on. So, you know, based on all of these ideas, you know, I feel like I need to conduct some studies. So for my dissertation work, I conduct a pilot study with 6 very preterm infants. So very preterm infants, meaning born before 30 weeks gestation. So they are like a little bit smaller than older side of the preterm infants. And then we found that feeding in a side lying position actually led to lesser rate instability and, you know, fewer and shorter breathing interruptions and also better overall physiologic regulation. And then I expanded studies to a bigger study because I was lucky to have some NIH fund to support that. So, but that study, because, you know, we have a larger sample, we also was able to look at, you know, whether the intervention worked differently for different infants. So basically whether it was more or less helpful depending on their age or their illness severity. And this really kind of helped us provide evidence for, you know, whether feeding support or position can be tailored to each infant's needs. So we kind of found the similar patterns in this bigger sample, you know, like what I found in a pilot study. But, you know, the unique findings from, you know, for this bigger study was the biggest benefit were actually in the most vulnerable infants, you know, those born earlier or with higher illness severity, who often have the most difficulty learning how to, or, you know, feed orally, right? So this kind of reinforced something very important for me, like feeding is not just a task we complete every few hours, 3 or 4 hours, you know, it's a neurodevelopmental event. So, you know, every feeding is kind of opportunities for the infant's brain and body to practice coordination, regulation, and interaction. It's not just about how much milk they take, right? It's about how their neurologic system experiences that feeding. So if feeding is repeatedly stressful, then the infants may begin to associate that with the instability, discomfort, or pain, right? But if we support regulation, and if we kind of create a calmer and more manageable experience, then feeding can become more positive and developmentally supportive. And when that happens, we're not just helping them kind of finish the bottle. You know, we may be shaping how they approach feeding and possibly, you know, other challenges long term. And actually, that shift in perspective really changed how I think about feeding in the NICU.
Amazing.
That's amazing.
Very true. And I love the feeding is a neurodevelopmental event. I think that's not always the perspective or mindset that's approached for feeding and how it becomes so critical to that development. So that was your dissertation and that was your work. Haley.
Well, and then, so Jinhee, could you please clarify, when did you have that second study?
Yeah.
The larger, the NIH funded.
Oh, yeah. That was like a couple of years ago. You know, I got NIH funded grant. And then I actually collect the data from one of the hospitals in Boston. And yeah, that's probably the largest studies in the feeding position research so far. And then, we are kind of wrapping up the analysis at this point. So
how many babies were in that study?
So there were 60 babies in this study, but each baby actually were fed twice, one in the spine and one in the side lying position. So we have a total of 120 observations from the studies. And then it took probably almost 2 years to get the data.
When you just kind of lightly said, we were lucky to have NIH funding, and then you just went on. And I'm like, that's a really big deal. It wasn't just luck. So I think we need to revisit that and say that you worked very hard for that and you earned that, and you shouldn't just say it lightly. congratulations on all your hard work. And it was a very impressive study
so far. Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. And what I find really interesting about your work, Jinhee, is you're able to identify a gap based on clinical reporting and be able to pursue that and fill that gap with research. And I think that that is something really powerful, because I think we hear so often from our clinicians, they're seeing this or they want to see this. And maybe that doesn't match what we're seeing in the research, but like there's that evidence gap. And so it sounds like you used that to be curious about it and pursue, you know, what are the answers to these questions that we have in ways that we can kind of either test or confirm that what we're seeing from clinical report is what's happening more broadly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's very important to work with the clinicians. Otherwise, we are probably siloed and then, you know, conduct the research that's not quite meaningful for clinical practice. So that's not
relevant.
Yeah, I wanted to do some research that's going to be helpful for clinical practice and meaningful for them. Yeah, so that's why I always kind of try to listen to clinicians' voice and what is the actual gap in clinical practice and how can I support that. So I really think it's very important to kind of work together, clinicians and researchers, and also families, right? Because, you know, they are the people's kind of telling us what needs to be studied.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We talk a lot about how teams and individuals are collaborating and what that looks like. How do you work with other disciplines as you're pursuing your projects and your research projects, especially knowing how mindful you are about working alongside clinicians and families, and especially in such an environment as the NICU, which can be...
Especially I am working in the feeding ward, you know, of course the SLP, OT, or, you know, other feeding specialist is definitely important collaborators for me, and kind of, you know, having a better understanding of what is going on in clinical practice. And also they're so helpful to help me interpret the data that findings that I got, because sometimes I'm kind of puzzled why I'm having this, and then they're kind of chime in and then help me to understand why you kind of got the findings like that way. So I always kind of try to work with a feeding specialist somehow, and then I always kind of include some neonatologists too, because they also kind of bring a different perspective on the feedings, and yeah, they care about nutritions and feedings and stuff. And nursing, and then, also, you know, most recently, I kind of really, interested in like, some sort of a family focused work. So, we know the infants rely on their parents and caregivers. So without partnering with the families, we cannot truly provide a good care, right? Mm-hmm. And then the NICU is incredibly stressful place for parents. So I kind of trying to kind of address that parent stress piece and then well-being. So I haven't really collaborated with psychology. I mean, well, I did for the other, not the NICU work, but I wanted to kind of look for some collaborative opportunities with the psychologist too, to address those parent pieces.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and kind of continuously pursuing other perspectives and how to integrate that and really get that wider view. A lot of times families are expressing that they know that something's wrong. I mean, this is what we hear a lot on the Feeding Matters side is, you know, we know something's wrong, but we don't know, no one's listening to us, or we don't know how to share it. And I think a lot of your work kind of is adjacent to that and really helping give language to parents or give a tool to parents to be able to express themselves in a way that maybe is more respected or listened to from the field. So maybe share a little bit about, I know at some point, I think we probably have to overview all of Feeding Flock and all of the tools at some point. So we will. But maybe since we're dovetailing that at the tail end of this, maybe just approach that a little bit. And then we'll have you back on to really go in depth into Feeding Flock world.
Yeah. I mean, if you're kind of talking about standardized ways of measuring or, you know, kind of giving a common languages for parents and providers can speak about, then I really cannot talk about that without mentioning Feeding Flock.
Yeah, exactly. No, and it's okay. Too. I just figured we'll need to do something comprehensive later on. But it'd be great to introduce everybody to some of that right now.
Yeah, sure. So maybe I can briefly talk about what the Feeding Flock is, right?
That'd be great.
Yeah. So
maybe start from there?
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, sure. Before kind of jumping into the PD right away, just to give a little bit of background about the Feeding Flock, that was actually formed like almost 20 years ago, right, Haley? Yeah. So that was like during my PhD, when I met colleagues who were asking similar questions about pediatric feedings and then my pre-doc mentor and also Haley's pre-doc mentor brought us kind of together and we started meeting regularly, just informal conversation at first, kind of exchanging ideas and supporting each other, how hard PhD program is, kind of the stuff. But over time, those meetings grew into a long-term collaboration and eventually into what we now call Feeding Flock. But one major accomplishment from the collaboration was developing a feeding assessment tools. So I think the reason why we developed the tool was we wanted to conduct the longitudinal studies, I think, to understand how common feeding problems are and how children's feeding problems changes over time.
Yep.
But when grant proposals were reviewed, we kept hearing the same feedback, right? There was no validated tool to measure feeding outcomes over time.
Yeah.
But, clinically we knew children were struggling, but we just scientifically, we did not have a strong measurement tool to document it, basically. So we decided, why don't we just develop them ourselves? So, that decision kind of turned into like maybe 5 or 6 year journey. We're still working on project to refine and expand them. So, honestly, feel like it never ends. But from that collaboration, we developed a 5-parent-reported tool, which assess feeding skill, children's feeding skills, and then the behavior and the impact of feeding challenges on parents and families and how family manage feedings in daily life, right?
Yeah.
And all of these tools, not all, but the most of these tools are normed, which means, families and clinicians can see how a child compare to peers of the same age. So they basically see where my child is at. Mm-hmm. And we also kind of made a very intentional decisions to distribute them freely to clinicians and family. In just the past 2 years, I think they've been downloaded more than 20,000 times. Are now being translated into really multiple languages and used all over the world. So, to me, that really kind of confirmed something important. There was a real gap, right?
There was. And bring me back to that. Gap.
Real gap, and people needed a better tools. So, I'm pretty sure Haley feel that way, but, I feel very grateful that, we were able to contribute something practical that supports both researchers and, researchers and families. And I'm hoping, families kind of, and clinicians too, they can use those tools to have a better conversation and, kind of more common languages to discuss about the problems and also kind of, measure their problems a little bit more objectively and standardized way.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people, it's also been helpful from navigating how they build their goals. And especially as they're even to talk about shared language, communicating with insurance companies, because I think that is also such a challenge when you're trying to help show change over time with things that maybe don't have a tool to measure, or it is a little bit more challenging to be descriptive in a way that an insurance company may be looking at that.
Yeah, I know that was really important for having the standardized scoring.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then some of the things we hear from families was like, they say like, I feel like my child has a problems, but I just cannot explain it well to the clinicians. So, you know, we're actually hoping our tool, maybe the parents kind of can fill it out and then hand it to the clinicians or providers, then that makes them, you know, kind of easier to have a conversation about the problems their child has.
Yeah, that's I think very much happening. And it's great to see how many people are really taking up those tools and using them in the different ways that they're intended to be used. So really amazing work, Jinhee. And thank you so much for sharing your entire portfolio of interest in your specialty areas, and also sharing a little bit about the Feeding Flock research group and all of the tools that you all do with Haley. And so as we're kind of narrowing in, we have our like last question, but I kind of want to just get a sense from you of like where you see the future of this work going, your work, your interest. You've been so good at identifying gaps. Are there gaps or trends that you're interested in now?
So I kind of think, so when I actually look at the Feeding Matters missions and then also the my work, I think there is the reason I'm saying it is like that's probably the future work that I want to do. So what Feeding Matter does is like supporting children and families with pediatric feeding disorders, right? And connects closely with the work I do in the NICU, I think. Because in the NICU, we work with infants who are at risk for PFD.
Yeah.
And then we help them develop kind of early feeding skills and when possible, prevent problems before they even arise, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we support families during very critical period. So I think that by linking early NICU care with the ongoing support, probably the Feeding Matter most do, right? And then we can build some sort of a bridge between prevention and rehabilitation, I feel like. So, you know, we can help children both before and after feeding challenges occur. And I think that this approach really complements the Feeding Matters effort to improve outcomes for children and family and feeding, with a pediatric feeding disorder. So I hope, you know, I continue kind of bridging those early prevention with the rehabilitation and family-centered care. And I definitely love to see NICU work and, you know, organizations like Feeding Matters working even more closely, kind of connecting all innovation with the ongoing support. And ultimately, it's about kind of really helping children, you know, approach, feeding positively and reducing long-term challenges and empowering families to feel confidence and supported throughout their journey. So that's my kind of...
That's amazing, Jinhee. And it's so just perfect for how you even started your conversation and sharing how you got into this work. Haley had mentioned you do so much to build the technical with the comfort and all of those pieces, and you're just such a bridge builder. And even in that answer of really looking at bridging between prevention and rehabilitation and those early feeding experiences, you can just tell that you're kind of that really forward thinker. And that's,
thank you.
Yeah. So I just felt like we came full circle. So thank you so much for being on with us. We really, really appreciate it and really appreciate your work and are really grateful to share your work with our community and continuing to seeing where we can build those bridges and collaborate to work on both prevention and rehabilitation. So thanks, Jinhee.
Thank you. Thank you for giving me opportunities to share my journey here and be part of these conversations.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. Thanks, everyone. Have a great week.
Bye.
Did you miss the live International PFD conference? All conference sessions are now available on demand, including every presentation from the live event, plus additional on-demand only sessions. And to keep the conversation going, we're hosting live Q&A sessions with conference speakers, giving you the chance to explore the topics people are still talking about. Go to feedingmatters.org/conference and log in or register today and start watching before the sessions close on April 30th.